obviously we can't sell land that doesn't belong to us. And so there would be actually something the Canadian government, the U.S. government, and the state of Alaska would have to discuss.
A dispute over boundaries in the Beaufort Sea. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 27th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, more evidence of increasing acidification in the Arctic Ocean.
It will take time for us to be able to say we're seeing a decline in the number of pteropod, for example.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business, and by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Canadian and Japanese research vessels are finding widespread acidity in the Beaufort Sea off the coast of Alaska and Canada. The waters are corrosive enough to dissolve the shells of marine organisms. Melting sea ice appears to be the main source of the acidity, but not the only one. APRN's Steve Heimel reports.
For three summers now, the sea ice in the Arctic Ocean has melted back drastically more than it ever had been known to before. Some of the consequences of this are known. For instance, fall winds now build up more wave action on open water and cause coastal erosion. Also, the Arctic heat budget changes because open water doesn't reflect as much sunlight as ice. But the ecosystem consequences of this big change are far less easy to track. It's expensive to get out there in icebreakers and collect data. And even when it is collected, data points from the past to compare it with are scarce to non-existent. But thanks to a Canadian expedition that misfired in 1997, there is a record of how acid the Beaufort Sea was that year. And measurements taken last year show a huge change, according to Fiona McLaughlin of the Ocean Sciences Institute of the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans. The maps were printed in this week's Science magazine.
You can see in that map areas in blue. That's undersaturated. The levels in green are neutral, if you like. And it's a very small area that's red compared to 1997 when it was all red.
Undersaturated means acidic. Back in 1977, Canada's Sheba experiment was supposed to lock a ship into the sea ice. But the sea ice broke loose and it drifted, taking the ship with it. McLaughlin, who's right now writing up government proposals for more icebreaker trips, was glad to be able to point to an entirely unintended positive result from an experiment that 12 years ago was regarded as a bit of a failure.
The data were acquired as part of the escort of that ship out to the site to be frozen in. So we try to take advantage of every opportunity to conduct science on icebreakers.
When the sea ice unexpectedly melted back dramatically in 2007, 10 years later, McLaughlin and a team of Japanese and U.S. researchers realized that if they could take another expedition out, they could make comparisons with the Sheba data.
So in 2008, we collected these measurements and were able to produce surface maps, and we were very surprised to see the undersaturation of omega aragonite to cover such a large region.
Omega aragonite is needed to build shells. When it turns negative or undersaturated, shells begin to dissolve. For certain plankton living in the upper part of the ocean, this is very bad news. But over time, there have been very few measurements of these creatures' distribution or abundance, so scientists will have to continue measuring to get what they call a time series.
It will take time for us to be able to acquire sufficient time series data to be able to say we're seeing a decline in the number of pteropod, for example, or in the number of forams, or that sort of thing.
The meltwater acidity is just part of a larger pattern. Waters are also becoming more acidic because the oceans absorb close to half the carbon dioxide that's being emitted into the atmosphere. Plus, the deeper waters are more acidic. When they start upwelling because of storms on the surface, which now have more wave action because sea ice has diminished, they also make that water corrosive. The multinational team took more measurements this year. That data is not ready for publication yet, but McLaughlin was willing to generally characterize it. She says the acidity was still there in the Beaufort.
Yes, we collected measurements this year, and we have a larger geographic area. And preliminary results indicate that this area of undersaturation has increased.
Most of the previous measurements of acidity in Arctic Ocean waters have been over the continental shelf. This report documents the first observations of water that's acidic over a deep water basin in the Arctic. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Canadian officials say Alaska is encroaching on the Yukon's turf, and the Member of Parliament for the Western Arctic wants the Prime Minister to step in. Dennis Bevington told the Canadian Parliament this week that the United States has authorized oil and gas exploration in an area of the Beaufort Sea that is claimed by both nations. He wants Stephen Harper to, at the very least, demand the issue be settled in the world courts. The CBC's Brian Boyle has more.
The dispute has been on the back burner for more than 30 years now. The two nations can't agree on where to draw the invisible line out into the waters of the Beaufort Sea to separate the two countries. Historically, that line simply extends the straight line up the Yukon's western edge, following the 141st parallel out into the Beaufort Sea. But the United States contends the line should be redrawn to run perpendicular to the coast. That would swing the line eastward, giving the U.S. a giant undersea triangle containing 21,000 square kilometers of potentially rich oil and gas resources. Western Arctic MP Dennis Bevington wants Canada's Prime Minister to put his foot down on where the line should be.
The Prime Minister needs to bring this up at the highest level with the diplomatic circles with the United States.
Bevington doesn't want to see any saber-rattling over the issue, but he says if diplomats can't sort it out, they should turn it over to the lawyers before anyone starts to drill.
If permits are given in the disputed area, those should be immediately taken to the international courts for intervention.
The Canadian government isn't saying what specific actions it's taking to prevent U.S. drilling in an area claimed by Canada. Brian Boyle, Whitehorse.
Alaska has recognized the land dispute between the U.S. and Canada. In the final findings for bidders to use in preparation for the lease sale published November 9th, Division of Oil and Gas officials say the U.S. State Department has notified Alaska of the title dispute and that potential bidders should, quote, be prepared for possible delays in determining state title to lands within this tract. State Director of Oil and Gas Kevin Banks says the dispute arose during the mid-80s over different methods of determining national boundaries. He says the tract has been offered for lease for more than 10 years, and it's still available. Besides the title dispute, Banks says the tract is offshore from the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, remote from infrastructure. He doubts there will be bids, but a positive response could lead to resolution of the dispute.
If the tract were leased in this lease sale, that would trigger a sequence of events where, obviously we can't sell land that doesn't belong to us. And so there would be actually something the Canadian government and the U.S. government and the state of Alaska would have to discuss. There'd be some value here that would be the subject of some discussion.
He says with area-wide leases, the state often offers tracts before the title work has been completed. It's common practice, and the lessees understand that. Banks says the state has made a commitment to offer all the land available with only a few sensitive exclusions.
That way people can plan for it, sometimes years in advance, in terms of establishing targets that they would like to acquire for establishing that oil and gas land position. So we're just sort of keeping to our commitment there.
Bank says while the tract is offshore from ANWR, it's not the 1002 area of the refuge. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new book looks at the wartime capture of a teacher on Attu Island.
On June 7th, 1942, the Japanese invaded that island. That's how she became a Japanese POW.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
A new book tells a little-known story of a teacher on the Aleutian island of Attu who was taken prisoner by the Japanese during World War II. Attu is the last island in the Aleutian chain. It was invaded by the Japanese in June 1942. Etta Jones was living there with her husband, Foster. They were both teachers who had spent two decades living in remote communities across Alaska. Jones was a prolific letter writer. Her great-niece, Mary Brew, uses those letters to write the book, Last Letters from Attu, the true story of Etta Jones, Alaska pioneer and Japanese POW. Brew says Jones originally came to Alaska with her sister.
Etta told her sister that she would go, but it would be for 1 year only. And so they both went out there for this one-year adventure. And at the end of the first year, her sister went back to the East Coast, and Etta stayed.
And what kind of life did she make for herself here?
She was hired by the, it was called the Alaska Indian Service at the time, and she spent the next 19 years teaching in remote Alaska, Native Alaska villages.
What was it that she fell in love with Alaska? Here's a young woman from the East Coast. Why did she fall in love with a place like Alaska?
I think she fell in love with the lifestyle and the culture and everything that Alaska has to offer. I think she just immersed herself in the Alaska lifestyle. That and she was happily married to a person who was also in love with the Alaska lifestyle, and that's why she stayed.
How is it that she ended up becoming a Japanese prisoner of war?
She and her husband, in being assigned to different Native Alaska villages, were offered a position on the island of Attu, and they accepted it as their last position before they retired. And so that's why they were there. And on June 7th, 1942, the Japanese invaded that island, and that's how she became a Japanese POW.
How much did that incident change her life? How long was she held?
She was held for almost 4 years. And what amazes me about this remarkable woman is that she was 62 years old when it happened, and then she was a POW in Japan for almost 4 years, and when she came back, she lived another 20 years. And it just takes a very strong person at that age, I think, to survive that traumatic ordeal.
Was it difficult, or how difficult was it for you to write the chapter about the actual invasion?
It was extremely difficult. The whole process from the time I started writing the book until it was published took 7 years. And so in the first 2 years, I wrote the chapters that led up to the invasion and the chapters after the invasion. And I delayed writing the chapter about the invasion for 2 years because I knew what was going to happen. And knowing and loving her made it extremely difficult. So finally, after 2 years, I knew it had to be done, and so I just knuckled down and did it, and it was really hard.
How much did she talk about being a prisoner of war when you knew her?
Unfortunately, I didn't have the good sense to ask her any questions. My mother, however, tells me that if she were asked questions, that she would answer them. She didn't elaborate, but if they asked a question, she did respond. She didn't clam up. She would answer the question and let it go at that.
How has immersing yourself in your great aunt's story affected your life? How has it changed things for you?
I have more admiration and respect for her than I ever had when I knew her and in the subsequent years. She died in 1965, so it's been 40 years since then. And what it has done is just, I'm just in awe of this woman. Another thing is that her story is so unique. She was the first female Caucasian taken prisoner of war, or taken prisoner on American soil since the War of 1812. And she should be, as far as I'm concerned, she should be as well known and as famous as Susan B. Anthony or Clara Barton or, you know, any other female who was an American figure. She should have been. Unfortunately, her story is a footnote in America's history, and that's why I felt very strongly that her story needs to be told.
Mary Brew is the author of Last Letters from Attu, the true story of Etta Jones, Alaska pioneer and Japanese POW. The Army will permanently station an aviation brigade at Fort Wainwright that's been at the post on a temporary basis. U.S. Army Alaska spokesman Major Bill Kuppernall says the formal record of decision listed on the Federal Register this week cements positioning of the unit's 1,200 soldiers and 70 helicopters at Fort Wainwright.
Those are the numbers that are reflected in the record of decision. So there's no indication that there's going to be an increase in personnel and equipment beyond that that's already taken place at this time. I guess what is different is that the Army temporarily stationed those soldiers and helicopters in Alaska to support the training and deployment of our Alaska-based units, but they were not assigned there permanently. Now, this decision permanently stations those units that have been in Alaska since 2005.
The aviation unit is in the process of returning from a year-long deployment to Iraq.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. People are either sighted or blind, right? Wrong. Many eye conditions can lead to low vision. People with low vision have some sight, but even with glasses, they may still have trouble doing things they're used to. A low vision assessment helps people identify special tools and skills to live on their own independently and succeed at work. Learn more at 248-7770 or alaskabvi.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Center for the Blind and Visually Impaired with support from Lions Clubs.
The new president of the Southeast Conference says she will focus on improving the region's energy and transportation infrastructure. Maxine Thompson became the organization's board president this fall. The Angoon businesswoman and former mayor is the first Alaska native to lead the organization of industry, government, and other Southeast leaders. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has the story.
The Southeast Conference formed more than 40 years ago to advocate for creation of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Decades later, it continues to influence the system, lobbying state officials and the legislature. Board President Maxine Thompson says this year's focus is to fund the Alaska Class Ferries, a new generation of ships designed for shorter sailings.
We have and we are still going to be advocating for annual appropriations to the Vessel Replacement Fund. Our marine highway system is going through an ever-increasing financial burden with the aging vessels, with replacement parts having to be located in foreign countries.
The conference plays the role of Southeast's regional development organization for the state. That means it's very involved in a number of energy projects. One is the Cape-Petersburg transmission line, which is in the planning phase.
It will still take a year or two, probably two, to finish this phase, and then construction can begin if the funding can be obtained. That is the next focus for the CAKE project, getting securing construction funds.
The conference is also involved in the Reynolds Creek Hydropower Project, which is nearing construction on Prince of Wales Island. It's also helping look at energy options for Hoonah and Pelican on Chichagof Island. Thompson says she does not expect Southeast Conference to become involved in the current debate over subsistence management and enforcement, but she says it should be watched.
There is an economic development issue there. You know, our communities with high unemployment are having to give up subsistence collecting activities as the cost of fuel increases.
At the most recent conference meeting, leaders were criticized for the way their elections were held. Tlingit Haida Central Council President Bill Martin distributed a letter saying board seats were structured to pit rural native candidates against each other and protect white urban incumbents. Thompson disagrees. She says the board tried to make it easier for village residents to run, even extending a deadline for one candidate.
As a native representative, I was joined by Jan Hill, the mayor of Haines, and Patricia Phillips, the mayor of Pelican. So I feel we have good Native representation at the board table.
Thompson says it's important for the region's larger cities and smaller villages to remember their connections. She says the conference recognizes that what affects one affects all.
Our small communities, whatever they are experiencing, affects us as a whole. If we're going through hard times financially, if our fishing didn't do any good, it does affect our urban communities. So the whole concept of what's behind Southeast Conference is something that has kept me enthralled with that organization, that they focus on the region. What does our people need in order to move forward?
The Southeast Conference is headquartered in Juneau and has about 150 members. They include municipal governments, businesses, nonprofit groups, and individuals. Thompson's term lasts 1 year. She takes over from Skagway tugboat captain Mike Korsmo. In Juneau, this is Ed Schoenfeld.
When the Exxon Valdez plowed into Bligh Reef more than 20 years ago, scientists descended on Prince William Sound in droves. Few, if any of them, took Alaska Native traditional knowledge into account in recording their findings, and no doubt valuable information about the animals and flora of the area was buried under an oil slick of disparagement thicker than the scum of North Slope crude blanketing the Sound's beaches. As KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, some Native educators are working now to fight against Western research bias with an all-Native perspective on natural sciences.
Ida Hildebrand lets her excitement show through when discussing a Native curriculum that is yet to be written.
The cry for Indigenous materials by Indigenous people is profound. The passion of the students who get so excited about just hearing about the concept, it's remarkable.
Hildebrand's working with the Chugach Regional Resources Commission's Executive Director, Patty Brown Schwallenberg, on getting that Native perspective into a textbook.
Native students respond better if something is taught that makes it relevant to them and the way they think and the way they view the world. It's been a concept that's been around a while, but we're finally getting to the point now where there's money behind the idea, so to speak.
Brown Schwallenberg says Alaska Natives have been managing natural resources for thousands of years anyway, although they don't often write about what they do.
But their Indigenous knowledge has not until recently been recognized by Western science. And so what we're trying to do is blend the Indigenous knowledge with Western science to reflect the validity of both.
Hildebrand says it will take three people to accomplish the K-12 project, a researcher, a writer, and a scientist in residence.
To ensure that the curriculum is reflective of the local culture. Reflective of the local values, the local beliefs, anything that pertains to that resource from a Native perspective, why that resource is important.
Brown Schwallenberg says after the 1989 oil spill, contributions by Alaska Natives of Prince William Sound were discredited.
The tribes in the region were anxious and willing to be involved in the restoration process and the research and monitoring associated with the oil spill, but it was very difficult for their ideas to be funded, not only by the Oil Spill Trustee Council, but other organizations as well. Part of it was, I think, there was a professional bias if you didn't have a biologist on staff or a PhD, people think that you can't do the job or you don't know what you're talking about. And so our board decided that education would be the best way to solve that problem.
CRRC has already developed a course on tribal resource management on a college level, now available at UA Fairbanks.
So the material is out there, and also the hunger for material that is culturally relevant to any region, to every region. And literally in teaching the classes, the students, Native students' eyes glaze over if you just stay in Western science and the Western textbook. But the moment you start speaking of their culture, their values, their belief systems, and then how it relates to that subject, the lights come back on and they're very engaged.
Brown Schwallenberg says the initial elementary curriculum will focus on the Chugach region, although the program is set for a trial run in the Fairbanks area. The tribal textbook idea is being endorsed by the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society, which works to promote Native natural resources management. According to a posting on the NAFWS website, the textbook is not expected to be an encyclopedia of Indianness, but the first of several texts and reference materials that are being written by Indigenous people from an Indigenous perspective. Sally Williams speaks for the NAFWS from Denver.
You know, our people are geniuses. You know, they're PhDs many times over, you know, in what they know as far as, you know, the knowledge of the natural world. You know, our people are here now, you know, and you know, they know what they know, and they know what they know now.
NAFWS is working to secure funding for the textbook project and has put out a plea to tribes across the nation for input and support. That support could spark a revolution in how we view our Earth, and that spark could be felt around the world. Ida Hildebrand says there is interest in the project abroad.
I think it's suitable for any school across America, even out of America. Out of America because on an international level, everyone is looking to Indigenous knowledge as part of the solution for whatever the problem is.
The textbook already has a name, Our Ancestral Voices, although it is still in the planning stage. Brown Schwallenberg says it is expected to be in use in about a year. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from the CBC's Brian Boyle in Whitehorse, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.